Golden Delicious apples were developed in West Virginia. But will growing them on abandoned mine land yield economic fruit for Appalachia?
We already have a potential partner to develop further, but it hasn't been anything official. If they don't come, somebody else will.
I'm Kara Holsoppel. This week on the Allegheny Front, how some are looking to rebuild and re-green in the places coal left behind. Plus, we'll look at the environmental winners and losers after the midterm elections.
People care about the environment, but when it comes to saying things like, hey, are you willing to accept a tax? I think that's a much harder sell.
And if you're going to bring up climate change this year at the Thanksgiving table, we have some tips for making that conversation matter.
Take some risks in talking a little more deeply about it with them.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. State regulators have ordered the owner of a pipeline that exploded in Beaver County on September 10th to shore up eroded slopes along the pipeline's route. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports.
Officials say heavy rains led to a landslide that caused the blast along the Revolution Pipeline in Center Township. It burned one nearby house to the ground. Following the explosion, the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection inspected the entire 100-mile route across four counties in western Pennsylvania. The DEP found multiple violations, including unreported landslides and erosion into several streams along its path. Neil Shader is a DEP spokesman.
Currently, there's potential for additional pollution. There are pollution, there's runoff impacting these streams already.
The agency ordered the company to cease all earth disturbance activities except for those needed to stabilize the route. The company said it would comply with the DEP's orders. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
As a result of the midterm elections, Philadelphia suburbs will be sending more Democrats to Harrisburg in January. Although that suburban blue wave won't be enough to wrest legislative control from the GOP. But as State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports, many of the newly elected suburban lawmakers are united in opposition to a controversial pipeline project.
Danielle Friel-Otten says she never thought about running for office until Sunoco began building its Mariner East pipelines 50 feet from her back door. Opposition to the pipeline drove her campaign, and that stance helped her defeat incumbent Republican Becky Corbin for the 155th district seat in Chester County. Friel-Otten says a frustrating battle over the pipeline led a number of her neighbors to take action.
There was a group of us that sat around a patio table last summer, and we talked about what can we do, what are our next steps, and we agreed that we needed to get people to step up and run.
Pipeline construction has resulted in drilling mud spills, sinkholes, and contaminated water wells in Chester County. Friel-Otten says in Harrisburg, she'll work to make Pennsylvania a leader in renewable energy. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
The environment played a role in the midterm elections in lots of races across the country, and in some cases, it was literally on the ballot. To get a post-election take on environmental issues and the midterms and what's next, I talked to George Kalink. He's a congressional reporter for E&E News, and I caught up with him by phone at the Capitol on the day after the election. Well, let's talk about climate change first. Washington state voters rejected Initiative 1631, which was a ballot question that could have established the first carbon tax in the U.S., and it would have put a $15 a ton fee on carbon in the state. And I understand that a lot of money was thrown at this from the fossil fuel industry. What do you make of this?
Well, it doesn't seem like carbon tax is going anywhere fast. This is the third time in 3 years this was rejected, so there just hasn't been a groundswell of support for this amongst the general public. We also saw here on Capitol Hill there was an effort earlier this year by some environmentally minded Republicans who joined with Democrats to try to pass a carbon tax, and that didn't sell well either. So I just think it's a very tough sell to convince voters. I think a lot of voters and, you know, a lot of people care about the environment, but when it comes to saying things like, hey, are you willing to accept a tax that will ultimately impact you, whether it's on you directly or on services or products that you use, I think that's a much harder sell. And I think that's what we're seeing with these referendums. I think the supporters of it believe that they're educating people by offering this, and they're hopeful that, you know, as more attention is focused on climate change, then perhaps the day will come for a carbon tax.
A lot of people were saying that if this couldn't happen in Washington, which is like a more environmentally conscious, supposedly, place, then, you know, what kind of hope would it have anywhere else in the country?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the interesting thing, though, is that with Democrats taking back the House, I do think you are going to see some renewed focus on climate change from Congress, and that could raise the issue to the public more. For example, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, who is expected to be a candidate for Speaker, said that she'd like to bring back a select panel on climate change in the next Congress that was in place last time Democrats controlled Capitol Hill and held hearings on climate change that ultimately helped lead to cap-and-trade legislation. It was disbanded when Republicans took over, but Democrats wanted to bring that back. So those types of things could build support for it and maybe down the line momentum for state ballot initiatives like the one we saw defeated in Washington yesterday.
Of interest to other states that have fracking, like Pennsylvania, where we're based, there was a referendum on new restrictions on the oil and gas industry in Colorado, which failed to pass. And it would have doubled drilling operation setbacks from homes and would also have set aside land that couldn't be touched by oil and gas. And the former and the newly elected Democratic governor of the state were both against it. You know, I guess, is it a surprise that it was defeated? And what does it signal for how government is dealing with the industry?
You know, there was a group called Protect Colorado that was formed to oppose this issue. And they really made it about economics, that if you go forward with this, there's a chance that it will hurt the economy, hurt funding for schools and public safety, because companies aren't going to want to come and locate in a state that has these strict environmental regulations. I think that's why you saw some bipartisan pushback on it, because it became seen as an economic issue, not simply a matter of preserving lands.
Of course, the biggest news, as you mentioned, from the midterms is that Democrats have gained a majority in the U.S. House of Representatives. How could this affect the trajectory of rollbacks of environmental protections that the Trump administration has begun at EPA, even the possible criminal investigation of the Secretary of the Interior, Ryan Zinke?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. I think there's a big impact. I think really riding that wave of suburban angst, and the Democrats did take control of the House last night, they're probably going to have a narrow and maybe 10-seat or so margin. But in the House, that's all you need. You just need a few seats and you control the agenda. And in particular, I think it means that they're going to really increase oversight of the Trump White House. And that means hearings, perhaps into, you know, what EPA is doing or not doing on climate science. It might be looking into some of Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke's travel spending, things like that. And that's an issue that Nancy Pelosi, in her first press conference since they took back the House, repeatedly emphasized oversight and the need for Congress to serve as a sort of a check and balance to the Trump administration. So I think you'll see that. I think legislation, certainly the House Democrats will push legislation on climate change, greater environmental regulations. I'm not sure how much success they'll have with that, because the Senate will still be in Republican hands. But what they will be able to do is, whereas when the Republicans controlled both chambers, they were able to move bills, often blocking Obama-era environmental policies, they'll no longer be able to do that. So it will slow down some of the regulatory rollbacks that you referred to.
And how might having new leadership, like newly chaired House committees, like the Committee on Science, Space and Technology, or energy and commerce, change things?
I really think that the change will be Republicans tended to focus more on energy issues, and environment and climate change got so much short shrift. I think you'll see a flip. I think you'll hear a lot more talk about environmental justice issues, I mentioned earlier that I think you'll see them establish a climate panel to focus specifically on climate change. And, you know, if you look at the people leading that committee, starting with New Jersey lawmaker Frank Pallone, who's expected to be the chairman, he's somebody who's viewed as an environmentalist. And I think you see a lot of folks that will be in the senior roles on the Energy Commerce Committee viewed as environmentalists, people who are committed on climate change, Superfund site cleanup type of things. So I think that will be a big change from a lot of the Republicans who are viewed as more tied to the energy industry. I'm on the House Science Committee. The favorite is Edie Bernice Johnson from Texas to take that over. Again, I think what really happened in recent years on that committee is science became a really partisan issue, a lot of questioning of science that we hadn't seen before in the federal government. You know, there's long sort of been a bipartisan tradition of federal science research, but Republicans really began to push back on that, especially as it related to the environment and climate change. I think Democrats will definitely push to allow for funding for that. I'm not sure how successful they will be with the Republicans still in control of the Senate, but they'll raise the issue. And again, I think they'll also raise a lot of questions about Trump's denial of science, particularly on climate change.
George Kalink is a congressional reporter with E&E News. I spoke with him about the midterm elections for our Trump on Earth podcast. You can hear more at trumponearth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple. We can get gridlocked in facts and opinions when we're talking about climate change with someone who doesn't share our point of view. So maybe there's a better approach.
Asking them, what is it about this that concerns you, is something that might take the conversation further.
Coming up later on the Allegheny Front, tips for more productive conversations about heated environmental issues. Stay tuned. Can apples grow on an abandoned coal mine site? That's a question the West Virginia National Guard is spending more than $5 million to answer. The Guard has 1 year left of this three-year project. West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Roxy Todd traveled to Nicholas County, West Virginia, to find out how the first batch of apple trees is doing.
$30 million was given to West Virginia in 2016 to invest in economic development projects across the state. The money came from the 2015 omnibus federal spending bill passed by Congress, and there was a catch to this money. Groups would have to build their projects on former abandoned mine land sites. The idea was partly to spur new jobs in coal country, but also to speed up reclamation of mine sites. Some of the funding went to develop industrial parks, and others went to agricultural projects, like this one, managed by the West Virginia National Guard. Sergeant Major Daryl Sears walks me up a hillside. We're in a small community called Muddlety in Nicholas County. Behind an electric fence, rows of young apple trees are growing as far as my eyes can see.
The majority of this AML property up here, you can plant the fruit trees on. Some of it needs a little bit of help in the sign of lime and fertilizer and balance to the pH, but honestly, almost every soil in West Virginia does.
These 3,000 trees are expected to live about 30 years. They aren't producing many apples yet. They're only 2 years old. And they're tiny, a type of dwarf apple tree that will need to be trellised. There are different varieties, but most are a type of apple that was developed in West Virginia, the famous Golden Delicious. Sergeant Sears says they're sweet, and that makes them great not only for eating, but has also attracted a major private investor, a producer of apple juice and apple vinegar.
So we already have a potential partner to develop further, but it hasn't been anything official. If they don't come, somebody else will.
If that type of private investment pans out, this orchard could eventually provide about 400 jobs and $1.5 million in tax revenue for the state, according to an economic impact study done by West Virginia University. Sears and nine other employees work at this orchard now. By the end of next year, he says they'll have planted 250,000 trees on this site. But not everyone is convinced this plan is the best scenario. Commissioner of the West Virginia Department of Agriculture, Kent Leonhardt, says he'd love to see the National Guard's project succeed, but he has questions about their approach.
Why did they choose juicing apples when juicing apples are the lowest value of an apple that there is out there? Why aren't we going after table apples and a processing plant where we can cut them up into the sizes that our youth need in our schools?
Using some of the apples for eating is still part of the National Guard's plan, but they're hoping that by bringing in a larger company, the project will have more long-term investment beyond the current grant cycle, which ends next year. Another question Commissioner Leonhardt has is, why is the National Guard investing in agriculture? Adjutant General Hoyer, the man in charge of the West Virginia National Guard, says their job is not only to deal with natural disasters, but also to help find ways to solve economic and environmental challenges.
We as a state have to start thinking a little bit differently.
And that includes looking beyond coal for ways to use the land that's been left behind by years of mining.
I think our role from a guard perspective is to take that property and turn it into something for West Virginia's future.
But is a mine site really a suitable place to grow an apple orchard?
And it all depends on the type of soil that you've got and its productivity potential.
This is Jeff Skousen, a professor of soil science at West Virginia University and an expert in reclamation of mine sites. He estimates there are about 500,000 to 600,000 acres of abandoned mine land sites in West Virginia. Some have been reclaimed or cleaned up. Others have not.
And I would guess that probably a fourth of that area might be suitable for farming.
Most of this abandoned mine land is still owned by mine companies or private landowners, but it could be developed into a post-mining industry, like growing apples, if the soil is free of contaminants and if there are enough nutrients to support farming. Skousen helped the National Guard select the site for their Nicholas County orchard, and he tested the soil.
These soils are not toxic. There's nothing wrong with them. They're just fairly coarse, and by that I mean they're rocky. And so that means that they don't hold as much water and hold as many nutrients.
He advised the guard to add more potting soil to the dirt to give more nutrients and to help break up the tough clay. He says he's hopeful the trees will continue to thrive and produce, but it will be a few more years till they'll know for sure if they were successful. But an earlier apple tree project the National Guard was involved in was not. I went to Clay County to have a look at the apple trees.
None of them are alive. There's a few sticks sticking out of the ground. The ground itself is really dry and arid. This is a former mine site, so it's pretty dry here.
This project was headed up by a nonprofit called the Central Appalachia Empowerment Zone, and the West Virginia National Guard helped plant all the trees in 2015. I asked General Hoyer about this earlier project.
The follow-up on those trees is not like the follow-up in the orchard that we have at Muddle Tea.
You don't think it's an indication of the poor soil quality?
No. I think it was a matter of they just didn't have the folks to care for the trees. So I think it's two completely different circumstances.
According to the State Department of Environmental Protection, the site where these apples were planted was mined by Greendale Coal, which had its permits revoked in the late 80s. The agency says reclamation was later done on the soil, but there is an issue with acid mine drainage. It's not exactly clear if any of these environmental issues had anything to do with why the apple trees died. The organization that headed up this project, the Central Appalachia Empowerment Zone's executive director, Connie Lupardis, didn't want to do a recorded interview about this project. She says she was told by the DEP that the site would be appropriate to grow apples, and they did grow initially. She says they only received a little more than $20,000 for this pilot project, and if she had to do it all over again, she would make sure she has workers in place to care for the trees once they're growing. I can't help but wonder, are these projects just the byproduct of the coal industry and people who support coal? Are they just trying to prove these lands aren't completely wasted? I posed the question to Jeff Skousen.
No, I understand. I think you're trying to say, you know, is it people like me that are trying to justify continuing to destroy the environment to get coal out? And then, yes, there is a post-mining land use that we can develop and that we can move on and that these have value.
He says that he looks at the positive side of all this, that just 40 years ago, mining companies were doing much more damage to the environment without much work being done to reclaim their mine sites. Convincing coal companies to do a better job has taken a lot of work and federal regulation. Back up at the Muddlety site, Sergeant Sears says another generation from now, apples and other fruit trees could be one of the things covering these hillsides. And he says he does think this project will be more successful than the Clay County project.
And as far as them doing better here than over there, I mean, it's just a matter of testing. I mean, to see, you don't know until you get them going, but they appear at this point, and you'll be able to see when you go up here, they're doing quite well here.
He says in about 4 years, we'll know for sure. That's when the 250,000 trees they're planting for this pilot project are expected to start producing apples. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Roxy Todd in Muddlety, West Virginia.
Well, it's almost that time of year again, Thanksgiving, where we gather around the table to enjoy food and family, and sometimes have awkward conversations about politics or hot-button issues like climate change. A while back, I spoke with Mary Beth Manarino about this. She's a professor emeritus at Chatham University and a clinical psychologist. We talked about how to navigate a family gathering where there might be lots of different views on these issues. Well, a lot changed since then. President Trump was elected, and his administration began dialing back climate policies. So last year, I asked Mary Beth Manarino to come to our studio and give me a refresher. I'm going to play a clip from the last time that we talked a couple of years ago. And the question I asked was, how do we begin to have a conversation with someone about climate change or any touchy issue, a person that you know or maybe suspect has a different opinion or point of view about it than you do? And here's what you said.
If you reach out and ask the other person about their beliefs and what do they know about climate change, and show a genuine interest in it and why they feel so strongly about it, and then you're meeting them where they are, and then you can say something like, I've done a lot of thinking about this as well because it's potentially very upsetting. And here are some things that I've done to educate myself about it. So that's one of the things, is to meet them where they are and then kind of express yourself in a way that respects that they may be different.
So is that still your advice?
In part, I would stand by that. I think what I'm finding now is that people who are involved in fighting climate change, other environmental issues, or even other political concerns, is that there is a sense of urgency that has increased. And so that potentially brings more energy to the conversation, often on both sides, which can either make it go even better or can really cause it to blow up. So, yes, I stand by meeting them where they are, but I would also go a little deeper and take some risks in talking a little more deeply about it with them.
How would you do that?
I just recently participated in the climate reality leadership training. And one of the very simple questions that we can ask at those times is, if you meet someone who really doesn't buy into the reality of climate change, you can just simply ask, what about that concerns you the most? And many times you'll find out that there's just a misunderstanding of facts or even a level of avoidance of finding information. So taking the risk to not just kind of accept what the person is saying, but really asking them, what is it about this that concerns you, is something that might take the conversation further.
The Climate Reality Leadership Core Training, that presentation was given in Pittsburgh recently. It's given all over the world, and it's led by, of course, former Vice President Al Gore, as sort of a way to train people really to not only talk about climate change, but to kind of convince people about climate change and take action.
Right. And one of the other things that I would say about this is that if you are passionate about this, find a way to communicate that passion in a positive way. There's a way to do that without denigrating people who don't buy in, but just by example, showing them that you have learned so much and you have so much still to learn, but you're really in it for the long haul because it matters so much to the future of our grandchildren and even our current lives. I think I would honor that passion that you carry about it if you are an activist and not just try to soften that. In psychology, one of the things we talk about a lot is speaking from the I position rather than you, so that you can still stay engaged in a conversation by saying, this is what I believe, and this is what I have found out, and what I know, and why I'm in this, without attacking the other person or assuming something about how they feel.
How do you do that without giving them a bunch of facts, like that we're warming at this particular rate, and if we keep going, there's a lot of facts. I know that Al Gore has a lot of facts.
Al Gore has a lot of facts
in his books and his presentations. So, how do you do that?
Well, that's a great question, and that's one of the things I've learned through experience, but also that Al Gore himself emphasized, is that most of us have very personal stories that we can draw on to tell people about this. For example, my family is from the mountains of eastern Kentucky, where mining was the major industry. And I have learned a lot about how the fossil fuel extraction and mountaintop removal has devastated communities and people's health. And so when I talk about that from a personal perspective, I can also invite somebody else to talk about experiences that they've had with nature. One of the things I have found in teaching graduate students in psychology and counseling about these issues is that we can't just launch the semester with the facts about these things. And what we do is we actually spend a couple of weeks looking at our personal relationships with nature. And people are invited to think about places that were very special to them for one reason or another, and to go back to remembering the sensory experience of being there and the emotional and spiritual experiences. And then also to imagine if those places are still intact and thriving, what would it feel like to have that place be devastated by some kind of environmental disaster or cumulative effects of toxins and climate change? And people often have a powerful reaction to that when they can personalize it.
Mary Beth Manorino is a professor emeritus at Chatham University and a clinical psychologist. We spoke last year, and there's more of our conversation at AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Kara Holsapel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.